Coming up on this week's episode of Check Your Balances, we talk about the capital gains exclusion for your home, 403b to 401k transitions, and the time value of money. Stick around, that's coming up next.
Check Your Balances is a show produced and owned by Kraftwerk Capital. The views expressed by the hosts and their guests are personal opinions and should not be considered personal financial advice or the opinion of Kraftwerk Capital. All investments have risk and may lose money. Consult with your financial advisor, tax preparer, or attorney prior to implementing anything discussed, and please do not use this show as the sole basis for financial decisions.
Welcome back to another week of Check Your Balances. I am Ross Anderson, joined as always by my friend and co-host, Dan Maseka. Good to see you, bud.
Good to see you.
I think we both just had a learning experience on whether or not we are good at flipping a biased coin. This is not how we intended to start our show, but literally you just sent me a game, or really an experiment, and it paused us for a flat 10 minutes as I decided I had to play and get to the end result. So now we're talking about this.
Yeah, I got an email from some, I don't know, newsletter service I signed up for at some point in time.
IdeaStorm? Is that a regular read for you?
No, it's just recently started popping up in my inbox. So it must be tied into something else I'm reading, and they just found me, and clearly I'm who they want because I read through this whole thing and came across this game. The idea being, if you had a biased coin that had a 60% chance of landing on heads, and I started you with a pile of $25, and you can bet on this coin for a full 10 minutes, how much money would you end up with? The caveat being that if you get to zero, your game is over. And I think the lesson is supposed to be, even with an edge, 60% edge, that's huge in gambling. That would be huge in investing. Even with that edge, it can still be potentially difficult to come out ahead. So we sat down and played, and we haven't talked about it yet. We just hit record.
Yeah, literally, we don't know how each other did. So the coin flip experiment, they reference Victor Heghani. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. I'm sure I'm not. Who is one of the founding partners of the long-term capital management hedge fund. And he designed this to basically show with an edge. So I think the statistics, first of all, are really interesting. So you're given a biased coin, and 28% of the participants still lost all their money. So the odds were in their favor. Almost a third of the people lose their money, and 33% had less capital than they started out with, meaning they're under the $25 that you get at the beginning of the experiment. So you've got 50% of the participants that, when the odds are in their favor, either lost money or lost all of their money, meaning that the other roughly 48% or so were on the positive side. And they basically say of the participants, the biggest category was what they called a poor showing. You end up with $25 to $100. Better but not great was $100 to $200. And then maxed out was $200 plus, because I think there was an actual cash prize when they were doing the experiment with real people. But that's fascinating. So Dan, I know you just went all the way through it. How did you do?
So I played twice. The first time I landed up with a little over $500. I felt pretty good about that.
But you stopped early, right?
I stopped 2 minutes early. That's true.
Okay.
And then the second time, I got to 110.
Okay. I got to 132. What was your philosophy? First, I guess couple questions. Number one, biased coin, it's gonna land on heads. Did you ever bet tails?
No, I picked heads every time.
I did too. And then how did you position size your bet against what you had in your bankroll at the time?
So I started out betting $5 of my 25. I figured I had five hands at that. I like my odds of not going bust in that time period. And then kind of I ratcheted it up as I hit certain benchmarks. So when I got to 50, I would increase to 10. At 100, I'd increase to 20 and keep going up. And where I had trouble was when I lost a couple hands after I ratcheted my bet size up, just trying to figure out where to adjust it back down to right size for that. Yeah. But that was generally my take. And then my other thing I did at the end, it was interesting because it showed you the average player. I felt that the more I could flip the coin, the better it was. So I flipped it as fast as I could, as frequently as I could. And I think I had double the flips of the average player. So you know, I figure I should take the edge as often as I can in my 10 minutes.
Yeah. I also had kind of a funny betting technique early. I kind of screwed around with it. I started at $1 and then just started increasing the bet. And then I kind of tried to do the same thing, right? Because I was trying to get as much money on the table as possible because you've got a likelihood of winning, but you need enough flips to basically absorb the losses. And then where I ended up at the end is I started betting just 25% of whatever the bankroll was. And so it sounds like you were kind of in a similar spot of like 20% starting out of what you were going to bet. But I ended up with just 25%. And, you know, it got me to $132, which isn't the greatest number, but at least I didn't lose money. I felt good that I didn't lose money. And I do think it was fairly disciplined to play the heads every single time versus guessing on a losing hand and maybe getting a few right.
I thought it was funny when you said 132 that you had a specific number, like with the two at the end.
Yep.
And I'm like, all of my numbers ended with a five or a zero, which means that you had a more structured strategy than I did, where I was trying to keep things clean and round for myself.
Well, this is interesting. We're going to put a link to the game in the show notes. So if anybody is listening to this and wants to try this, take your chances with a weighted coin virtually. And we'd love to know how you do. You can send us an email at checkyourbalances@outlook.com. Let us know if you were able to beat Dan and I on your coin flip experiment. Let's get on to our actual show today, which is similarly where we listen to what you want us to talk about. We went into the mailbag and pulled out a few emails of some people that have written into us. I'm going to start with what I think is the toughest one we're going to try and even address. And honestly, it's going to end up coming out and sounding like a punt. But this came to us from Andy. He says he's a pretty new listener, but enjoying the podcast. He's a UK citizen and has lived in the UK for most of his life, but married a US citizen in 2021. They've spent some time in the UK, are nearing the end of the green card process, and are expecting to become US permanent residents in January to start a life in Alexandria, Virginia. So shout out to Alexandria, and Andy, welcome. That is right down the street. His question is that our podcast has been a useful resource, but all of his financial knowledge is UK-based. And basically, what are some tips, tricks, things that we can think of for getting set up in the US for a new resident? They're going to be a two-income household, rent for a little bit. Sounds like maybe thinking about buying down the line here. There's a lot to unpack there because there's a few moving parts. But Dan, what was your immediate reaction after reading that email from Andy?
My immediate reaction was I have no idea what we can offer of value to him. But after I sat with it for a second, I think one of the biggest changes, right, the U.S. tax code is so complicated. Andy has the benefit of being married to a U.S. citizen who hopefully has some of the information about operating financially in the US. But I think understanding the different retirement buckets that are available to you in the US is probably a great start. So we've got pre-tax accounts, we've got Roth accounts. Understanding how they work and where they may be appropriate for you would be my first step if I were to do something and just familiarize yourself with how to get ahead for retirement.
Yeah, I think there's kind of two main stages here. Number one is you need to understand how the new laws are going to impact what you have. So I went to the cross-border financial planning website. This is a UK website that basically talks about making this exact same transition. And step one for them was don't assume that your investments retain the same beneficial tax status. That the most common UK investments, including ISAs, are treated as passive foreign investment companies. And basically, that in that structure, income gains are taxed at the highest rate of U.S. income. That's a scary set of words. I don't know what those account types are. So I think my main point is you have to find an expert that knows this particular transition. Because foreign tax is so specific to the country where you're coming from, and then ultimately, obviously, where you're going. And so you need somebody that knows that UK to U.S. transition really, really well. I would be reaching out to a specialist here. I think Dan and I both have an above average knowledge of the US tax code, and that immediately goes past what we know. And so, you know, for any random person that's trying to make that transition, you need somebody that knows that inside and out, that specific set of tax codes between the UK and the US. I think the CPA is going to be your best friend there to make sure that you understand how those existing accounts are going to be treated. Secondly, you've got to think about what you're going to do on a go-forward basis, right? And so if you're planning to stay in the U.S., you mentioned kind of permanent residency in the U.S. And so if you're going to stay there, obviously setting up your new programs is going to be important as well. And that's going to be a few different things. So when you're married to a non-U.S. citizen, even things like estate planning change. The way that the money passes through an estate can be different than if both parties are U.S. citizens. So I wouldn't go, you know, corner cutting and use the online will and trust services, for example. And I think that those do a very good job for the average person that just kind of needs a, you know, I love you will is kind of what it's called. Like, hey, we're this is going to the spouse and then ultimately to kids. Those are pretty simple wills. I think an online service is fine for that. I think you're going to need an actual estate attorney. And so I would go through the process of interviewing. I think you can pre-interview folks. We are past the extension season for CPAs at this point. So this is a good time of year to reach out to them and say, hey, I'm making this transition. Is this something that you work in? Is this a specialty for you? And can we create a partnership? Because you're really talking about early next year. So if you lay that base before calendar 2024, I think you're going to be ahead of the game.
You're also moving to an area where a lot of people are coming from overseas. So there are an abundance of specialists who can help you, and finding the right person hopefully shouldn't be too hard. There will be one locally for you.
Yeah. Now, where we can give you some advice is on Alexandria, Virginia, because Dan and I used to work there and spent a lot of time there. So if you need restaurant recommendations, things of that nature, we can absolutely help you. Shout out to Andy's Pizza.
Yeah, we've eaten our way through Alexandria. We have some advice.
Yeah. And beware of Rocket Grill.
Unless you love karaoke.
It is an absolute dive and it's a lot of fun. But Rocket Grill can turn into a mess. So that's our Alexandria shout out. All right, Dan, let's get into our next one. This came to us from Jason. He wrote in and said that the capital gains exclusion of $250,000 per individual, $500,000 for a couple on a home sale, has it always been this amount? Is there any plans to increase them? Home prices have gone up a ton, so it makes sense to increase the tax-free exclusion on that home sale. Do you see any movement on that?
I believe it has been $250,000 and $500,000 since this came into the picture and has not budged since then. So I think that is a very good question because especially of late, home values have skyrocketed. So if you've been a homeowner for a decade, you know, $250,000 can look like nothing in the scheme of things.
Yeah, I feel like that's going to be something that does not change. That's just my instinct on it. I believe that that would be so unpopular when you're looking at a country that's running a pretty massive deficit in terms of cash flow, that giving away higher gains than $500,000 on a tax-free basis, that just feels like it's going to be unpopular. Like you're almost by definition selling a home at massive profits already. I think it's more likely that it would get lowered than raised. Now, again, I think the Realtors Association and I think the lobbyist groups that protect realtors and the home builders and everybody else, I think that they would throw a fit if somebody tried to lower it. But I would suspect that that would be the more likely direction than having it go up, even though we can all believe that it should be going up with the values of the homes.
Yeah, it's already massively favorable tax treatment that's biased against homeowners, right? It's an incentive to push you into a home. I'm going to make an unpopular statement here. I would vote for it going away. I think it's better for the country to have that not be something discriminating in favor of homeowners. And let's just, if we're in favor of lower taxes, let's lower taxes. There you go. That's my statement for today.
Yeah, Dan, coming out of the gate swinging. Well, yeah, it has helped me. I'm glad that it's been there. You know what I think it helps more than anything, Dan, is people that are not otherwise tracking their basis, right? Like in theory, if you bought a home and then you're going to do a big renovation project, yeah, you maybe put a bunch of money into it. And if you haven't tracked that and you can't justify that new valuation, in theory, your basis has changed. So I think it's a little bit of a sloppiness cover. You know, it's kind of a shield for people that otherwise aren't keeping track of when they do those improvements. Now, ideally, if you're going to be in the home for a long time, create a little folder, a little binder, something, a folder online in your, you know, Google Drive or whatever, and just save those receipts. Put a spreadsheet together that accounts for every time you do a major project, upgrade a bathroom, replace a roof. Just put the receipts in there, right? If you can document that you've been making those improvements, it's going to be much easier when it comes time to sell it. And that would become critically important if anybody ever took Dan's advice there and we get rid of that exclusion.
But needless to say, I don't think either of us have heard of them adjusting that level. It's been 250, 500 since the beginning. I haven't heard whispers of that on the table to change at the moment.
All right, let's move on to a question from Brian. He says he's been listening to every episode. I'm always shocked. I'm so
what up,
like
Brian.
Every time people say that to me, I'm like humbled because it's like, wow, that's awesome. I am so glad that you're finding value in the show. And then that fear that's always in my brain of like, oh my God, what did we say when we were doing this show 140 episodes ago? And now I want to go back and listen to them all myself and like screen my own content to make sure I didn't say anything silly.
Don't do it.
No, I'm not going to. I don't have the time, but I hope that you've been enjoying it. Maybe we've gotten better at this. Who knows? Maybe we've gotten worse, Dan. So we're going to continue to try. We appreciate everybody that has gone back and done that and consumed the catalog. So here's his question. Currently has a 401k, is looking to change employers, but they have a 403b. Can you do a 401k rollover to a 403b? Lots of numbers, lots of letters in there. What's going on between a 401k and a 403b, Dan?
Yeah, I mean the general answer is yes. So there are a couple things you want to be careful of, though. A 401k can have pre-tax and Roth money potentially. So you just want to make sure that the 403b can receive whatever types of balances you have in the 401k. But pre-tax 401k to pre-tax 403b, you should be good to go. In fact, the IRS keeps coming up with really cool tools and charts that blow my mind that they exist. The IRS does have a little matrix of different types of retirement accounts and what can go to where. So you can find the intersection of the two, and it says yes or no as to whether you can make that transaction. I found that very helpful for someone who's looking for a quick reference. So if you find 403b qualified plan, which is a 401k, you get to the intersection, it says yes, march forward, assuming that the tax buckets are the same.
Yeah. So, you know, when you're thinking about a rollover, you can always go from the old employer plan into a rollover IRA or a Roth IRA. So if you've got pre-tax or after-tax money in that 401k, those are always homes that you can put it in. The reason that you would be interested in going into the 403b, in my opinion, is a couple things. Number one, if it's just simpler for you to not have the extra accounts. So by having just one employer plan and rolling all the money into it, it's fewer things to keep track of. I'm with you on that. Number two would be if you are doing something like a backdoor Roth IRA strategy, where you are trying to limit the amount of pre-tax IRA money you have. Because again, on the backdoor Roth, what they're going to look at is the total aggregate of IRA dollars that you have. So if you've got any pre-tax IRA money, you're going to be paying some taxes when you do that backdoor Roth conversion because you're going to have to include it on a proportional basis. If that money goes into your 403b, it doesn't get looked at as part of that process. And so that could be a reason to do that. I think the third consideration is, do you like the investing options in this 403b? Right. So depending on the size of the plan, who they're working with, what funds are available to you, you might find that it feels restrictive. So you might look at the 403b and say, well, I don't really like the fund company they're with. I don't really like the expenses in this plan. That would be a reason to keep it out of the 403b, because in an IRA, you get completely open road in terms of your investment choices. So those are really kind of the three things strategically that I'd be thinking about is, can I make the transition into the 403b? And then do I want to, based on the other strategies that you're employing for your finances? So a few different things to look at there, but that's going to be the main considerations.
Yeah, just don't be scared of the 401k versus 403b terminology. They're very similar.
Yeah, they're functionally the same for most taxpayers. It's just a matter of where you work and which plan type was available to them to set up. I do love that those have become so ubiquitous, and that's just the line of code in the tax code. It's like IRS tax code 401 section K, which is what established the plan. And now we talk about that as like the type of thing that it is. It's fascinating to me.
Gotta love tax code.
All right, let's get into the last one. I think this is a little bit more philosophical. And I'm curious what your take was, Dan. We didn't prep this, so I have no idea. We're coming into this blind. This comes to us from our friend Ernie, who's been a longtime listener. He says, when determining when to take Social Security, do you consider the time value of money? A dollar at 62 is worth more than a dollar at 70, or does the cost of living adjustment negate the issue? So on Social Security, what we always talk about there is you could file as early as 62. For most people these days, the 67 is your full retirement age. That's where you get your normal stated benefit. At full retirement age, you also don't have to worry about making too much money. So if you file at 62 and you're earning a bunch of income, they start crediting against your Social Security. Once you get to 67, no problem. You can take and double dip. You can take your full Social Security, no penalty. You can keep earning every dollar you want. If you want to make $1 million a year and put your cherry of Social Security on top, that's no big deal. If you delay to 70, you continue to get increases. But there is a cost of living adjustment that goes along with Social Security. It does get adjusted for inflation. So I think that's what Ernie's asking about. Dan, what's your take?
Yes. So the two separate pieces happening here are the cost of living adjustment that you would get if you claimed Social Security. That's going to march along with the 1, 2, 3%, whatever they determine cost of living adjustment to be based on inflation. So you do get an increase, or at least to keep up with buying power if you are a Social Security beneficiary at the time. However, if you don't claim Social Security, you get bigger increases. So from full retirement age to 70, you're getting 8% increases on your Social Security benefit for waiting, which should pay you for waiting more than, you know, the erosion of value of the dollar because of the time value of money. So I think I don't necessarily look at the present value versus future value calculation in the same way that I think the question was presented. It pays to wait. You're going to come out ahead for waiting. However, I always put it in the context of someone's cash flow needs to see what fits their situation best rather than looking at it in a bubble. If you have the luxury of not caring, you know, then we look at it differently and might see what the utility of that dollar will be early versus later.
Yeah, so I thought about how I model this. And most typically, what I do in my calculations is I assign a cost of living adjustment to Social Security that is handicapped from my main inflation assumption in the plan. This is a little bit inside baseball, but so the core inflation rate that we're using in most of our financial plans is 2.5%. So we assume from this point forward, whatever you're spending per year is going to go up by about 2.5%. I can go in and adjust each individual goal to have different inflation assumptions. So something like college planning, where college expenses have gone up by 6, 7, 8% a year in certain circumstances, I can show that being really aggressive and kind of a sharp inflation on that specific goal. I can also do the same thing up or down when it comes to income streams. So with 2.5 being the baseline inflation, what I normally show for Social Security is 1.5. Now, the reason I do that is because the metric that I believe they use for Social Security is the CPI number, which excludes several key things that people buy a lot of, things like energy, things like food prices. Those are very volatile, and so those are taken out of that CPI calculation, but I think it is a very important part of our day-to-day lives as consumers. And so I will generally show Social Security going up by 1.5% rather than the 2.5. And so a little bit of drag on the cost of living adjustment. Realistically, is it about the same where it washes out for you and you shouldn't overly index to that? That's probably the real answer. Like Dan said, it comes back to cash flow when you need the money and how much stress your portfolio is able to kind of put up with in the pursuit of waiting. Those are the things that really lock in for me. But just so you know how we do the calculation, we do show a little bit of a drag on the inflation number from Social Security, just assuming that it won't quite keep up with the rate that your expenses go up.
And just to contextualize what you give up for claiming at 62 versus full retirement age, it can be 30% of your benefit is what you're giving up. So if you think you're going to out-earn the growth you would get by waiting, that's a pretty big handicap to overcome. Possible, but sizable.
It is. Yeah, it depends on the environment, right? And it depends on how enthusiastic you are about the stock market. The fun thing about enthusiasm with the stock market is that it is inverse to what has been going on in the stock market, right? It goes up. We get excited about stocks. We start to adjust our expectations higher. When it's been down, when it's been bad, when we're getting kicked a little bit, we tend to go, yeah, this thing's kind of a bum. It's probably not going to make me that much money. We should be thinking the opposite way. When things have been really exciting, we've had great 13% annualized runs over the course of the last 10 years, that's when you should be fairly modest in terms of your expectations, and vice versa. When it's been really crappy in the market, that is probably about the time to load up and start believing that we're going to revert back to the mean. And so, you know, that 7 to 10% range, which I realize is a big range, that's what we should be expecting annually from stocks. And I think that that's where, if we've been above that, we should expect some lower growth years in the future, not negative, lower growth, which is fine. Those aren't the same thing, but it's probably going to even back out to those long-term averages, which is kind of how we tend to do our planning.
Well said.
Well, I think that's it for today's mailbag. Dan, you've got some wine keys to send out. So for anybody, if we've been reading your question on the air, if you haven't sent us your address, your physical address yet, please shoot that over to us and we will get some wine keys sent out as fast as possible for you. We appreciate everybody tuning in. We love the questions. It's great to hear from our listeners. So check your balances at outlook.com. We would love to talk more about the things that are on your mind. What's going on in your financial life? Can you beat our coin flip game? Can you do better than me and Dan at bet sizing? We already told you our strategy. So if you figure out something better that works for you, we'd love to hear about it.
Do us a favor. If you enjoy the show, leave us a rating and share with a friend. We'd love to grow our audience and hear from more of you and speak to what's on your mind. So we appreciate everyone who's already listening and are looking forward to growing that family.
To quote Pat McAfee, be a friend, tell a friend.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll catch you next week.